From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It amazed me that psychologists were acting as a psychic wrecking crew for detainees, not just at military detention centers, but at CIA's black sites.
Rorschach and all. The latest expose of psychologists and their involvement in military interrogations and abuse comes from Vanity Fair writer Catherine Eban. We'll also speak with Dr. Brad Olson. He heads up 13 divisions within the American Psychological Association. He's calling for a moratorium on psychologists' involvement in military interrogations. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has proposed a major new arms deal with Saudi Arabia and greatly boosting military aid to Israel as part of an effort to counter Iran by arming its regional rivals. President Bush wants to sell $20 billion worth of high-tech weapons to Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. The sale could help spur a new arms race in the Middle East, as the Bush administration is proposing to give $30 billion in new aid to Israel and $13 billion to Egypt. Historically, Israel has opposed U.S.-Saudi arms deals, but Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said on Sunday he understands Washington's planning to supply the state-of-the-art weapons to Riyadh as a counterweight to Iranian influence.
In addition to the huge increase of the security aid to Israel, this was a renewed, explicit, and detailed commitment to keep Israel's advantage over the Arab states. We understand the need of the U.S. to assist the moderate Arab states, which are in one front with the U.S. and us in the fight against Iran. And on the other hand, we appreciate the renewed and re-emphasized support for Israel's military and security advantage.
Under the plan, U.S. aid to Israel will increase by 25%. The deal is expected to be officially announced today after Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates arrive in the Middle East for joint meetings in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Opposition to the Saudi arms deal is already emerging on Capitol Hill. Democratic Congress member Anthony Weiner and Gerald Nadler say they plan to introduce a resolution to block the deal. Congressmember Weiner said, quote, Saudi Arabia should not get an ounce of military support from the U.S. until they unequivocally denounce terrorism and take tangible steps to prevent it. The arms deal is being proposed at a time when Saudi Arabia's actions in Iraq are coming under increasing scrutiny. On Sunday, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Almeh Khalilzad, accused Saudi Arabia of undermining efforts to stabilize Iraq. Earlier this month, the Los Angeles Times revealed nearly half of all foreign militants targeting U.S. troops in Iraq have come from Saudi Arabia. Criticism of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez continues to increase. On Sunday, the editors of the New York Times urged Congress to impeach Gonzalez if Solicitor General Paul Clement does not appoint a special prosecutor to probe Gonzalez's actions. The Times accused Gonzalez of lying to Congress about his role in the political purge of nine federal prosecutors and about President Bush's warrantless wiretapping operation. New questions are being raised over the death of Pat Tillman, the football star turned Army Ranger who died in Afghanistan in 2004. The Associated Press has obtained new documents that suggest Tillman might have been deliberately shot by a fellow Army Ranger. The documents show Tillman was shot three times in the forehead. The bullet holes were so close together that it appeared Tillman was cut down by an M16 fired from about 10 yards away. Army medical examiners were initially suspicious and tried without success to get authorities to investigate whether the former NFL player's death amounted to a crime. The Pentagon initially told the public and the Tillman family he had been killed by enemy fire. Later, the military said Tillman was killed by friendly fire. A new study of California's electronic voting machines has raised new questions about the security of the system. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, a state-sanctioned team of computer hackers were able to break through the security of virtually every model of California's voting machines and change results or take control of some of the system's electronic functions. Secretary of State Deborah Bowen said the researchers were, quote, able to bypass physical and software security in every machine they tested. The test includes voting equipment made by Diebold and Sequoia. President Bush is urging Congress to rewrite the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to make it easier for the government to secretly monitor overseas and some domestic communications. On Saturday, in his weekly radio address, Bush said the FISA Act needs to be modernized.
It seeks to restore FISA to its original focus on protecting the privacy interests of people inside the United States, so we don't have to obtain court orders to effectively collect foreign intelligence about foreign targets located in foreign locations. It allows the government to work more efficiently with private sector entities like communications providers whose help is essential.
Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin accused President Bush of trying to exploit the threat from al-Qaeda to push the bill. Feingold said the measure is a, quote, egregious power grab that includes broad new powers that have nothing to do with bringing FISA up to date. The American Civil Liberties Union criticized the bill in part because it would give immunity from criminal prosecution and civil liability for the telecommunications companies that participate in the NSA program. The aid group Oxfam is warning that about 8 million Iraqis, nearly a third of the population, need immediate emergency aid because of the humanitarian crisis caused by the war. The report said 15% of Iraqis cannot regularly afford to eat. 70% are without adequate water supplies, and over a quarter of all children are malnourished. Jeremy Hobbs of Oxfam said, quote, basic services ruined by years of war and sanctions cannot meet the needs of the Iraqi people. Last week, Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, admitted that Baghdad residents can now only count on an hour or two of electricity a day. That's the lowest level since the U.S. invasion. Before the war, Baghdad residents received 16 to 24 average hours of electricity each day. Despite the ongoing war and occupation, celebrations were held across Iraq Sunday after the national soccer team stunned the sporting world by beating Saudi Arabia in the Asian Cup finals. After the game, the team's captain, Yunus Mahmoud, called for U.S. troops to leave Iraq. Mahmoud said, quote, I want America to go out. I wish the American people didn't invade Iraq, and hopefully it will be over soon. Pakistan's military ruler, General Pervez Musharraf, held secret talks Friday with opposition leaders and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. The pair met for an hour in Abu Dhabi to discuss a possible power-sharing agreement. Bhutto has lived in exile since 1998. Bhutto said Sunday she would not strike a deal unless Musharraf steps down as head of Pakistan's military. Meanwhile, 15 people died in Pakistan Friday in a suicide bombing near the Red Mosque in Islamabad. In India, police shot dead at least 8 protesters during a demonstration calling for the state to give government land to the poor. The protest occurred in the southern state of Andhra Pradesh. A state minister said police opened fire on a tent filled with people after some protesters threw stones at the officers. The protest was part of a day-long demonstration across the state planned by 2 communist parties spearheading the demand for free government land for the poor. Nilotpal Basu of the Communist Party of India said the chief minister of the state should step down following the killings.
We think that Rajshekhar Reddy has absolutely no moral right to continue in office. And not only has he fired people who were innocent and killed them, but on top of that, he is spreading the worst kind of falsehood. Television footages have shown that there were no provocation, no violence on the part of the demonstrators. Only when they attacked the people's leaders there, the people tried to rescue him. And in response to that, this kind of barbarity has happened.
Protests continue today in India. In New Delhi, police use water cannons to break up a student protest over the shootings. A new scientific study has found the annual number of hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean has more than doubled over the past century, largely in part due to global warming. The scientists said there's a strong correlation between the spike in storm activity and rising sea surface temperatures, which feed hurricanes. The Washington Post has revealed the Bush administration blocked the U.S. Surgeon General from releasing a report last year that called on the government to spend more money on global health issues. A Bush political appointee reportedly blocked the publication because it did not promote the administration's policy accomplishments. In the report, Surgeon General Richard Carmona described the link between poverty and poor health and urged the U.S. government to help combat widespread diseases as a key aim of its foreign policy. The report also called on corporations to help improve health conditions and warned about the use of pesticides. Carmona, who served as Surgeon General up until last year, was also prevented from publishing a report on health care in the nation's prisons. Here in New York, the city is proposing new rules to require many photographers and camera operators to obtain permits before taking photos or shooting video in the city. Under the proposal, any group of two or more people using a handheld camera in one location for more than 30 minutes would be required to have a permit and $1 million in insurance. In addition, small groups using a single tripod for more than 10 minutes would be forced to obtain a permit and insurance. On Friday, over 400 people rallied in Union Square to protest the proposed rules. This is civil rights attorney Norman Siegel.
We are a city and a country that values the right of expression, and to say to people who have cameras that they have to get permits if they're there for a certain period of time or if they have a tripod seems to me to be trampling on people's First Amendment rights. And we in New York need to speak up and speak up now, because otherwise we'll wake up and our rights will have eroded.
Over 6,000 people, including Michael Stipe and Patti Smith, have signed a petition in recent days opposing the city's proposal. In Georgia, former Democratic Congress member Cynthia McKinney has sued the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for libel. McKinney claims the newspaper misrepresented facts about her run-in with Capitol Security and that someone telephoned bomb threats to her office from the Journal-Constitution. And the Swedish film director Ingmar Bergman has died at the age of 89. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush, in his July 20th executive order, gave the Central Intelligence Agency the green light to resume some severe interrogation methods to question prisoners at secret prisons overseas. While the order explicitly bans murder, sexual abuse, and religious denigration, it remains silent on the use of psychological torture and specific techniques such as waterboarding, sleep and sensory deprivation, death threats, stress positions, isolation, and use of dogs. The story behind these interrogation techniques is the subject of an exposé titled Rorschach and Awe. It's by investigative journalist Catherine Eban. It was published in the July issue of Vanity Fair. Eban unravels the central role of two CIA-contracted psychologists in designing these tactics for use on detainees held in secret CIA prisons around the world. Her article is the latest in a series of revelations linking psychologists to U.S. military and CIA interrogations of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror. Although the two psychologists contracted by the CIA are not members of the American Psychological Association, many psychologists continue to voice grave concern over the APA's equivocation. In an open letter last month, leading psychologists urged the president of the APA to reverse its, quote, years-long policy of condoning and encouraging psychologists' participation in interrogations. Today, we spend the hour on the explosive issue of psychologists and their role in America's continuing use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that the International Committee of the Red Cross calls, quote, tantamount to torture. The pressure for a moratorium is mounting, with a vote expected in several weeks at the annual meeting of the American Psychological Association in San Francisco. Catherine Eban, the author of Rorschach and Awe, published in Vanity Fair, joins us in the Firehouse studio in New York. Brad Olson is assistant research professor at Northwestern University and a founding member of the Coalition for an Ethical APA. He was also one of the primary authors of the open letter to the APA president last month. Brad Olson joins us from Chicago. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Catherine Eban, let's begin with you. Talk about why you began this almost year-long investigation.
Originally, a group of psychologists had come to me from within the APA. They were highly disturbed about the results of a task force, which had determined that psychologists could follow military guidelines and American law instead of international human rights treaties if they were given directions by the military to participate in interrogations. Basically, they felt this was allowing psychologists to follow the lower standard of human rights, and basically it would keep them in the interrogation booth. Conversely, the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association prohibited their members from being involved in interrogations. So these group of psychologists were suspicious that there was some kind of quid pro quo, some sort of backroom deal with the Defense Department. I began to probe their allegations. It didn't quite line up from an investigative point of view. It seemed very fishy. There were accusations that the task force had been stacked with military psychologists, that the conclusions were preordained. And while there seemed to be a reasonable case for that, it didn't quite explain to me what psychologists were up to, because some of the military psychologists on the task force had actually protested the role of psychologists in interrogations. And the more I investigated, the more I heard about a different set of psychologists, a set of psychologists who worked for the CIA, who were involved in some of the interrogations of high-value detainees. And what I learned was that those group of psychologists were actually the architects of a regime that amounted to torture, and that their tactics, which were what we call reverse-engineered tactics from a military training program called SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, rippled through the entire system like a demented game of telephone, in which these tactics were used not just at the CIA black sites, but in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo.
Explain what you mean by reverse engineered.
The SEER training program, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, is intended to train American soldiers who are likely to be held captive in the event of a war to resist interrogation techniques from a fictional enemy, as it were. Basically, they are exposed to Soviet-style interrogation techniques that include waterboarding, sleep deprivation, extreme temperatures, religious degradation. They are exposed to this in an effort to inoculate them against the stress of capture. There are a group of psychologists who oversee that program in order to ensure the safety of the American soldiers who are undergoing the training. They are supposed to prevent the trainers from behavioral drift and prevent the soldiers from getting harmed. It was those group of psychologists who ended up working for the CIA as contractors, who made a case that they had a method for making people talk. And so it was those reverse-engineered training methods that were used on detainees.
Talk about who the key psychologists are that you detail in your piece in Vanity Fair. Yeah.
The two psychologists that I identified are James Elmer Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. They work out of an office in Spokane, Washington, Mitchell, Jessen, and Associates. They used to be associated with the Air Force Base Fairchild there and the Air Force SEER training program. And they are the ones who were, according to my sources, in charge of interrogation training at CIA black sites. So any trainers who were going to be working with detainees would wind up in a Mitchell Jessen shop where they were being trained by those men in those techniques. Critics, and there were many, referred to them, they had sort of two nicknames. One was the Mormon Mafia, which was a reference to their shared religion. And another one was the Poster Boys, because people thought that their activities would land them on the FBI's most wanted posters.
What did they do? What interrogations were they involved with?
According to my reporting, James Mitchell arrived at the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. He was one of America's first high-value detainees. He was captured in March of 2002 in a firefight in Pakistan. He wound up in a safe house in Thailand. He was rushed to a hospital in order to save his life from infected wounds. The FBI had agents present at the scene, and because the CIA's interrogation team had not yet arrived, they began to interrogate Zubaydah. And what they used was classic rapport-building techniques that almost every FBI agent is trained in, which is to find common ground with the person you're interrogating, to treat them with humanity. And lo and behold, Zubaydah responded and talked. And not only talked, but gave them the name of the person who had been the entire master planner of 9/11, KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, referred to as Mokhtar. He identified him. He identified Jose Padilla. In other words, there was every indicator that rapport-building techniques were completely effective. However, after those disclosures, the CIA interrogation team arrived with James Mitchell in tow and said, now everything is going to change. We're going to get him to say everything he knows, and we're going to use these coercive techniques. And according to my sources, there was even a coffin present at the interrogation they were going to use to bury Zubaydah alive.
Hadn't George Tenet gotten involved between the two interrogations, between the FBI and the later CIA?
Right. Well, like most bad ideas in the war on terror, much of it is driven by a turf battle. So reportedly, Tenet was at Langley in a meeting. He said, I want to congratulate my agents on the ground for the disclosures. And then he learned his agents were not on the ground interrogating him. He got furious. He said, get that interrogation team there as quickly as possible. Make sure you keep Zubaydah alive. And so there was a clear turf battle. Now, the FBI agents who were present, once the CIA interrogation team introduced these harsh tactics, basically there was the equivalent of a firefight within the safe house over what kind of tactics were going to be used. And the FBI ultimately deemed that its agents could not be present while coercive tactics were being used. You know, the FBI is a law enforcement agent. Their goal and their training is to bring people to trial using interrogation methods that are permissible at a trial, which don't include any of these coercive techniques. Of course, you couldn't bring anybody to trial saying that you'd extracted a confession using these methods. And so the result of the fight within the safe house between the FBI and the CIA was to give the CIA, which had much less experience with interrogations, control. And that's how America's interrogation policies unfolded.
We're talking to Catherine Eban, investigative reporter, broke the story in the Vanity Fair of July, Cold War shock and awe. We'll be back in a minute.
Come, you masters of war. Here they build the big guns. Here they build the death planes. Here they build all the bombs. Here they hide behind walls. Here they hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to be...
Masters of War, Bob Dylan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guest, Catherine Eban. She's investigative reporter and writer with a number of national publications. Her latest piece, Rorschach and Awe, I have to correct. I said it was in the July issue of Vanity Fair. It is not in the issue of Vanity Fair. It is on the web at vanityfair.com. Actually, Catherine Eban, why isn't it in the actual publication?
There were so many developments that were breaking around this story, including an investigation by the Senate Armed Services Committee into the use of these reverse-engineered SEER tactics, that because Vanity Fair is a monthly magazine and we plan and print issues months in advance, we felt that it might not hold and we wanted to rush it into print, so we used the website.
So you were talking about the interrogation, first the FBI interrogation of Zubaydah, and then moving on to the CIA interrogation after George Tenet lost his mind, apparently, after hearing there was a morsel of good information out of Zubaydah, congratulating the team on the ground, but learning it was the FBI who got it rushed in the CIA team. The psychologist involved with that, explain further and what the role of that psychologist was.
Mitchell showed up at the safe house, along with the chief psychologist for the counterterrorism center, R. Scott Shumate, who I should mention was a member of the APA's task force on interrogation policy. Mitchell said that we're going to use these harsh interrogation tactics in order to extract all the possible information from Zubaydah. And among those, as I mentioned, was a coffin in which they were planning to bury him alive. Curiously, when this fight broke out at the safe house over the use of these policies, Shumate protested the tactics and subsequently told associates, as we had learned, that he thought it was a mistake for the CIA to hire contractors. Nonetheless, at the time, Mitchell said that the interrogators were going to be Zubaydah's god and that they would basically bestow privileges or take them away depending on his level of cooperation. And basically, his philosophy, as it was described to me by someone familiar with his use of tactics, is to completely break down a detainee through white noise, through complete separation of his personality, to completely unmoor him and make him completely dependent on his interrogators. And it was through that psychic breakdown that he planned to extract as much intelligence as possible.
You're right. The CIA put them in charge of training interrogators and the brutal techniques, including waterboarding, at its network of black sites. In a statement, Mitchell and Jessen said, "We are proud of the work we have done for our country." Where are Jessen and Mitchell today?
Well, my understanding is they are... They have their company, Mitchell, Jessen & Associates. It's actually, business appears to be booming. They have 120 employees out of their office in Spokane. They have classified contracts with the CIA. In their office, they even have what's called a SCIF, which is a secure compartmented information facility as a way to handle classified materials, classified training, classified documents.
Catherine Eban is our guest here in studio. We're also joined in Chicago by Brad Olson. He's an assistant research professor at Northwestern University and a founding member of the Coalition for an Ethical APA, also chair of the Divisions for Social Justice, which is 13 APA, American Psychological Association divisions, promoting a greater emphasis on social justice in the field of psychology. There looks like there will be a showdown at the annual convention of the APA that's taking place in a couple of weeks in San Francisco around the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th of August at the Moscone Center. Professor Brad Olson, can you talk about what is happening within the APA? You're head of 13 divisions.
Yes. Well, there's a wide, I should mention, there's a wide variety of beliefs. Psychologists are sort of across the spectrum on what psychologists themselves should be doing. And so, it ranges from some of the leadership in the American Psychological Association and others who believe that they've made very clear statements that they are against torture, although there's a very strong attempt to sort of maintain that role of psychologists in these detention centers as part of the interrogation process. And then there's other psychologists who sort of say that Principle A in the American Psychological Ethics Code is to do good and to do no harm. And so there's, you know, certainly there's absolutely no intention in this interrogation process to do any good to the detainee. And in fact, there's quite a bit of evidence that harm is occurring. And then there's sort of, so those are two groups. I mean, one group saying no matter what psychologists should be involved in the interrogation process. Another group saying basically that psychologists should not be engaged in interrogation. And then there's many, many others who say that, psychologists should not be in settings like Guantanamo or detention centers in Iraq or Afghanistan at all, and that simply their presence is facilitating the human rights violations that are going on in these
Catherine
settings.
Eben, you write about how the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, both of these associations have passed resolutions banning involvement in military interrogations. They will punish members who are involved. What has happened here with the APA, the larger association, American Psychological Association, of what, some 150,000 members?
Well, that is an open question. I mean, why does the American Psychological Association stand alone in allowing its members to participate in interrogations? Some would say because psychologists don't take a Hippocratic oath. Some would say because they have had long experience in assisting law enforcement with interrogations. However, I always found that comparison specious because a military interrogation or a CIA interrogation is occurring in an environment where there's no habeas corpus, where it's already been deemed that these detainees are not covered by the Geneva Conventions. So critics would argue that it's a fundamentally coercive environment. So there's no level playing field. There's no way in which detainees can invoke their rights because it's been deemed they have none.
Last year, Democracy Now! Hosted a debate on the role of psychologists in military interrogations. We included Dr. Gerald Kucher, then the president of the American Psychological Association, still a powerhouse behind the scenes. This is some of what he had to say about the issue of psychologists involved in interrogations at Guantanamo.
We don't, as a professional association, tell our members that they can't work for a given employer. Obviously, there are some people who don't think that psychologists should assist in the military at all. That's a political preference and a social statement, but there are many very beneficial things that psychologists have done in the military. One example is that the lead officer sent in to help clean up Guantanamo Bay was a psychologist, a U.S. Army colonel, who was sent in to help clean up the abuses as soon as they were reported. There's another APA member, a civilian employee of the Navy, who was sent to Guantanamo and was one of the first people to file complaints with his superiors about things that he observed down there, and he reportedly brought about some changes. I wish I had the assurance that Jane Mayer and that Dr. Reisner apparently have that there are APA members doing bad things at Guantanamo or elsewhere, because any time I have asked these journalists or other people who are making these assertions for names so that APA could investigate its members who are, might be allegedly involved in them, no names have ever been forthcoming.
That's Dr. Gerald Kucher, former president of the American Psychological Association, still very active in the APA. Catherine Eban.
Well, you don't make an ethics policy by citing a few positive examples. There has been an Army or a military line and an APA line that are surprisingly similar, which is that psychologists make interrogations safer and more effective. But what my reporting found is that the interrogations they make safer are the interrogations that have been made more dangerous. In other words, you take some very dangerous methods, like reverse-engineered SEER tactics. It's basically like letting a tiger loose in the interrogation booth, and then you get in an animal trainer to make sure that the animal doesn't go crazy. But why'd you put the tiger in the booth in the first place? In other words, psychologists were initially used in the SEER program in order to prevent against behavioral drift. So what the military is saying and what the APA is saying is psychologists can play that role in interrogations, but those are the interrogations in which these reverse-engineered SEER tactics are being used. Now, presumably, if you didn't use those tactics, you wouldn't need psychologists to safeguard them.
I want to turn to another clip. We've been having a series of discussions on this issue, and this is Jean Maria Arrigo. Early last month, we interviewed Dr. Arrigo, member of the 2005 APA Presidential Task Force, known as the PENS Task Force, Psychological Ethics and National Security. A year after the APA Task Force had released its report, it was revealed that 6 of the 9 voting members were from the military and intelligence agencies with direct connections to interrogations at Guantanamo and elsewhere. Dr. Arrigo said the task force report, quote, should be annulled because the process was, quote, flawed. I want to play for you a clip from our phone interview with her when I asked her to recall that meeting and the whole process they had of drafting the report.
Well, this is what I consider one of the very serious flaws in process. In the first morning, a person who was not a member of the panel introduced the question of confidentiality, and even though there was nothing on the table at that time that merited that concern, as far as I could tell, and the chair said that we would have to establish confidentiality or our position on that before we would go on.
Who is the chair?
The chair of the panel?
Yes.
Olivia Morehouse Slaughter.
And Dr. Slaughter?
Yes. And so this was actually the only issue that came to a vote, you know. And the reason for giving for confidentiality began with, this again was introduced by a non-task force member, is that we were there to kind of put out the fires, calm the waters, and that if we didn't have a confidential process, we would essentially be fanning the flames. So that was the first reason that was introduced. And then one of the military people was particularly concerned about possible retaliation by from terrorists to his family. And so the military issue became conflated with the putting out the fires proposal. And we had a vote at that time. I was very much opposed to confidentiality and voted against it. One other person abstained who was concerned about the military safety issue, and all others voted for confidentiality.
The issue of note-taking?
But the note-taking issue was more, hit me severely. I'm an oral historian, maybe even before a psychologist, and I always take notes. And I was told very sharply by one of the military psychologists not to take notes. No one defended my note-taking. No one else, as far as I could see, was taking notes except for an APA authority who had a computer there and took all the notes through the session and wrote our report. I don't want to say there's anything exactly improper in his doing that, but I think the fact that he was the only person taking notes officially was a great problem.
Did you continue to take notes through the discussion?
Pardon me?
Did you continue to take notes through the discussion?
Well, yes, but covertly, you might say. I can't think without taking notes. After lunch on the first day, we had a first draft of our report. And almost all of our effort was going to generating a report rather than thinking through it. And so I took notes in the margins of these drafts as they came out. So I did take very close notes on the first half day, and after that, notes in margins.
Do you feel you're violating the confidentiality agreement by speaking out today?
Do I feel that? No. I would say the reason I don't feel that is because as I came later to realize that the entire report had been orchestrated, I no longer felt bound by that confidentiality agreement. I thought it was inappropriate to begin with.
And so Dr. Jean Maria Arrigo has turned over her notes, the emails from the listserv leading up to this meeting and afterwards to the Senate Armed Services Committee. Catherine Eban, where does this go from here? And what about the significance of that was a two-day meeting, who not only was on the committee, the six of nine voting members in military, while the civilian psychologists say they understood that they were military, they did not understand the extent to which they had been key to setting up the key to the involvements in the interrogations.
I reviewed all of Dr. Arrigo's notes, all of the email correspondence from the APA task force, the listserv documents, all the documents I believe that Dr. Arrigo has turned over to the Senate Armed Services Committee. I spent really a number of months looking at those documents. But as an investigative reporter, there were things that didn't quite add up for me, which was that the military psychologists who were on the committee were a number of those who had actually opposed the most coercive tactics. So what was going on? I mean, that was my question. And really what it now looks like to me is that you had these CIA psychologists behind the curtain who were spreading the use of tactics that military psychologists ended up being blamed for, in part. And so, in a sense, they were the military psychologist and somebody like John Liso, who was a young psychologist who was drafted into the interrogation of Catani, were essentially plunged into an ethical quagmire that was not of their own making and that originated with these other psychologists. Now, of course, I'm sure there are people who say, you know, I'm giving the military psychologists a walk here. And, of course, there is a great deal that remains to be seen of their activities. But from my reporting, what I could tell is that they opposed, a number of them opposed, the most coercive tactics.
But what didn't happen was a call for a moratorium on military psychologists' involvement in military interrogations. Can you talk about the APA RAND meeting with these two CIA psychologists where they spoke?
Yeah. The APA RAND meeting proved to be very important to my reporting because I was able to obtain the attendance list, which is basically a catalog of the psychologists who are most involved in studying deception and interviewing, which is effectively those who are involved in interrogation policy. And lo and behold, Mitchell and Jessen were on the attendance list. The attendance list is divided into two parts. One was really academic researchers, and the other one was operational psychologists. So these were a lot of people who were associated with the CIA, some whose identity was so classified that they were only listed by first name in italics. Mitchell and Jessen were there on the list, listed as CIA contractors. And I think without that attendance list, I don't know if we would have been able to put out this article.
The CIA funded this APA RAND conference.
Correct. And one of the main CIA participants and organizers, a man named Kirk Hubbard, told a key participant before the meeting, don't ask these psychologists what they do for a living. Don't ask them to identify themselves because basically their identity is secret and classified.
And they debated the effectiveness of truth serum and other coercive techniques.
Right. That's correct.
We're talking to Catherine Eben, investigative journalist, has just published the report, Rorschach and Awe. That's published exclusively at VanityFair.com. When we come back, we'll continue with her and with a psychologist, Brad Olson, who leads 13 APA divisions, promoting greater emphasis on social justice. The meeting of the APA is coming up. It promises to be a real showdown in San Francisco among psychologists who are deeply concerned about psychologists' involvement in torture of prisoners. Stay with us.
Just read your paper and you see just exactly what keeps worrying me. Yeah, you see the world is in an uproar. danger zone is everywhere. My love for the world is like always, for the world is a part of me. That's why I'm so afraid of the progress that's been made toward eternity. Every morning, noon and night finds me hoping that everything's all right. The world is in an uproar, the danger zone is everywhere.
Danger Zone, Ray Charles here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations on public access TV stations and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish and audio and transcript form. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about the continued controversy within the APA, the American Psychological Association, as the annual meeting is about to take place. There are demands for a moratorium on military interrogations. That's being fought back by the leadership of the APA and a growing number of psychologists around the country who are refusing to pay dues, who are talking about introducing new resolutions to stop the connection between psychologists and military interrogations. Catherine Eban published the piece, Rorschach and Awe, exclusively at VanityFair.com. Professor Brad Olson is a psychologist at Northwestern University, founding member of the Coalition for an Ethical APA, chair of the 13 divisions within the APA, promoting greater emphasis on social justice. Let's go to you right now. Brad Olson, what is being proposed to be voted on at the APA at its annual meeting in San Francisco?
Well, that's an interesting question, because what was eventually supposed to be voted on Sunday of the convention was a moratorium that would basically say this. When we think about the Pens report and the Pens policy that was talked about, it was sort of this thumbs up to psychologists being engaged in interrogations, because if psychologists are engaged in interrogations, then the whole utilitarian argument of they're helping society, they're preventing terrorists from committing a terrorist attack. Since then, as you've talked about, there's been just a great deal of activity. Psychologists, as Catherine Eban in her article says, that a real crisis in the identity of psychologists and who we are. And I mean, a lot of us feel very differently about this, but the main resolution that was supposed to be put forth was a moratorium, basically saying, this has been going on for years and years, this debate back and forth since 2005 was when the Pens Task Force came out. And the moratorium basically said, let's hold off on this psychologist being engaged in these interrogations, and let's allow all of psychologists to debate this issue.
Who is fighting this, having a moratorium to investigate further?
Well, it's difficult to tell. I mean, what we do know is that clearly the staff of the American Psychological Association, some staff members who are very high up, are the ones that are really seem to be fighting tooth and nail.
Well, why is the APA so closely tied to the military and military intelligence? What is the history of this relationship?
Well, the history certainly goes way, way back. I mean, certainly in, some people might question the morality of any wars, but certainly some people would argue that World War II, that psychologists really were created some effective means and techniques to do some positive things. Although that there's also a great history of that being very sordid and sinister and harmful, which is exactly why we need to stick to our ethics code. But I mean, now it's a question: where are the ties? I mean, some people argue that that this has a lot to do with our competition with psychologists. Competition with psychiatrists.
And now that the APA has refused, has said that they won't be involved with military interrogations, that's the American Psychiatric Association, the APA can take over and play a greater role?
That's one possibility.
What about the use of this
issue of psychopharmacology? Should psychologists, I mean, that's the main distinction between psychologists and psychiatrists, or one of them, and that's that psychiatrists can prescribe. So there's a big movement within psychology to make it so that psychologists have prescriptive authority. And Walter Reed, the Department of Defense, set up the pilot program that essentially gave psychologists the foot in the door to start prescribing. And in fact, some of these psychologists are the very, the biscuit psychologists are the ones who have been part of this prescriptive authority program.
Well, that's...
But there's all sorts of different reasons. Some people argue that it has to do with appropriations and funding for research and just all sorts of possible connections.
Explain, Catherine Eben, who the biscuits are. And this is very interesting, this idea that the military might be the path through which psychologists can be able to prescribe drugs.
The biscuits... it's an acronym for the Behavioral Science Consultation Teams.
BSCT.
BSCT. And what happened at Guantanamo, I mean, the biscuits have been a focus of the ire of some psychologists who oppose involvement in interrogation by their profession. But initially, the biscuit teams were a tool of those who were pursuing rapport-based interrogation methods. I describe Colonel Britton Mallow, who was initially in charge of trying to investigate who at Guantanamo should be prosecuted or not. And he foresaw, he has an advanced degree in Middle East studies, he foresaw that there would be a tremendous cultural divide. So his group, the Criminal Investigative Task Force, reached out to Dr. Michael Gellis, who is a psychologist who was also a member of the APA task force, the PENS task force. And he set up a group of psychologists who would act as cultural advisors and advise on ways to bridge the cultural divide and employ rapport-building techniques and interrogations. Well, what happened was, as Mitchell and Jessen's tactics were promulgated throughout the system, it was like a sort of gravy train. It was the new hot idea to bring psychologists into the interrogation booth. So the head of the Joint Task Force Guantanamo, which was the main arm of the Defense Department to extract intelligence from detainees, said, "I want my own psychologists. So I'm going to go and set up my own biscuit team, and I'm going to pull psychologists who are involved in clinical care at Guantanamo and put them into these behavioral science consultation teams." So basically, something that started out as a good idea to advance rapport-building methods and interrogations turned into a tool to use coercive tactics.
We're coming to the end of the program. I wanted you to talk about the memo, the document that you got a hold of that has not seen the light of day, well, to the public before.
It is a memo drafted by JTF Gitmo, the task force I just talked about, and it is a SEER SOP, standard operating procedure, how to standardize the use of these coercive tactics in interrogation. And it basically, and it came about a week on the heels of Rumsfeld approving the most coercive tactics, and it lists a category of approaches to interrogations, and they include degradation, manhandling, omnipotence tactics, insults, slaps, walling, hooding, and how to use those dangerous tactics safely.
You write, in a bizarre mixture of solicitude and sadism, the memo details how to calibrate the infliction of harm. It dictates that the insult slap will be initiated no more than 12 to 14 inches or one shoulder width from the detainee's face to preclude any tendency to wind up or uppercut. And interrogators are advised that when stripping off a prisoner's clothes, tearing motion shall be downward to prevent pulling the detainee off balance. In short, the SEER-inspired interrogations would be violent, and therefore psychologists were needed to help make them, these more dangerous interrogations, safer.
Right. To me, this is, it really exposes the military's argument that psychologists are needed to make interrogations safer and more effective. What they were needed for is to oversee the use of these tactics so that they did not get out of hand and result in the death of detainees.
What if psychologists didn't participate? The doctors won't participate, psychiatrists won't participate. What if psychologists said no?
It would be very interesting to see what happened. Perhaps the military would need to shift tactics. But the problem is, and to go back to some of the questions you asked Brad Olson, the military has long been the largest employer of psychologists. We're talking about a jobs program. I mean, the relationship is long and deep. So there are certainly psychologists who feel that they are serving their country by being in the interrogation booth.
Brad Olson, there's a protest prepared that will be held at the American Psychological Association annual meeting. Is that right? On Friday in August.
That's correct. That'll be on August 17th from 4 to 5:30 at the stone stage of the Yerba Buena Gardens. And so the convention's going to go from Friday through to Monday, and we encourage people to come and voice their opinions. And they can get more information at www.ethicalapa.com.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you both for being with us. Brad Olson of Northwestern University, head of the 13 APA divisions promoting greater emphasis on social justice. Catherine Eben, her piece appears at VanityFair.com. It's called Rorschach and Awe. We'll continue to follow this story. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to get a DVD of today's broadcast or the transcript. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aramate, Anjali Kamet, Jay Babalota, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, and a very wonderful warm wishes to John Hamilton and Maddie Harper on their marriage. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.